Are you searching for a true crime podcast covering lesser-known cases involving military personnel, veterans, family members, and others associated with the military? On the Military True Crime Addict podcast, host David Kokish relates real true crime stories that the news media hasn't reported on, although when you hear these stories, you'll definitely wonder why. David deep dives crimes involving assault, harassment, hate crimes, abuse of power, murder, PTSD, hazing, rape, and other crimes committed by or against members of the military, veterans, and their extended families. On the Military True Crime Addict, David gives voices to the victims of these crimes and fights to raise awareness for those impacted by them. You don't need knowledge of the military to enjoy this podcast. If you enjoy hearing detailed true crime stories, the Military True Crime Addict podcast is for you. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 59, Munchausen Syndrome by Proxy, Part 2. In Part 1 of this series, I told you what studies and experts have to say about this commonly misunderstood condition. I also told you the beginning of the story of 5-year-old Garnet Spears. Garnet's death in January of 2014 was the culmination of 5 brutal years of unnecessary surgical procedures, medications, hospitalizations, induced illnesses, and gratuitous suffering at the hands of his mother, and the egregiousness of Garnet's story has made his one of the most well-known cases of Munchausen syndrome by proxy to date. In today's episode, I'll tell you the conclusion of Garnet's story, including his death and the 2015 murder trial of his mother, Lacey Spears. This is part 2 of the baffling phenomenon of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. My sources for this episode were The Journal News, Find a Grave, CBS's 48 Hours, Garnet's Journey blog, True Crime Daily, Newsweek, USA Today, New York Daily News, Twitter, Chilling Crimes blog, and the book about Garnet's case by John Glatt, My Sweet Angel. First things first, I'd like to give a shout out to my newest patron, Rebecca from Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan. Thank you so much, Rebecca, and thank you to all of my patrons. Your support gets me ever closer to my goal of devoting myself to the podcast and the blog on a full-time, permanent basis, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. If you haven't yet listened to part 1 of this series, I definitely recommend going back and listening to that one first, because it contains the first half of the story of 5-year-old Garnet Spears. Now that you've heard the first part of Garnet's story, I want to mention that his birth organism, Lacey Spears, bears a striking resemblance, at least in terms of behavior, to Casey Anthony, whose 3-year-old daughter, Kaylee, was reported missing in July of 2008. 6 months later, Kaylee's skeletal remains were found in the woods near her family's home in Orlando, Florida. While Kaylee was not the victim of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, her mother and Garnet's share multiple traits, most notably their ability to spout lies at the drop of a hat, and when they're caught in a lie, to pivot to a whole new fabrication without blinking an eye. Garnet's case, in particular his mother's behavior, reminds me of Kaylee's, bringing to mind something an Orange County Circuit judge once said about Casey Anthony:
"The truth and Miss Anthony are strangers."
The very same could be said for Lacey Spears. Lying, even when there's no reason to do so, can be a sign of a disordered personality. And although neither Casey Anthony nor Lacey Spears, to my knowledge, has ever been officially diagnosed with any kind of mental illness or personality disorder, it seems all too likely there's something of the sort underneath the surface for both of them. Casey was acquitted of Kaylee's murder in 2011. Fortunately, as we'll talk about today, that wasn't the case for Lacey. In my opinion, any potential personality disorder doesn't absolve Lacey of responsibility in the murder of her son. A personality disorder is not the same as a mental illness. These people are in full control of their actions. They make decisions and behave in certain ways because they've built a pattern of behavior over the course of their life, but they make the conscious choice to behave in the ways they do, including telling lies to benefit themselves in some way, to paint themselves in a certain light, and for any number of other reasons. I don't believe Lacey intended for Garnet to die. I do believe, however, that she consciously and purposely made him sick. Lacey is a remorseless, attention-seeking, pathological liar who forced her own child to endure a lifetime of unthinkable torture and, whether purposely or not, caused his excruciating death, all to garner herself sympathy and attention. Between the anger and the bone-deep sadness I've been battling since immersing myself in Garnet's story, I'm pretty emotionally drained right now. With my ramblings out of the way, now I'll tell you the rest of the story of Garnet Spears. I'll start with the beginning of the end. On January 12, 2014, Lacey Spears made the first of a series of 28 Facebook posts that would, over the next 11 days, document Garnet's slow-motion demise. It started with Lacey reporting Garnet was suffering flu-like symptoms, including a high fever and diarrhea. Her phone records would later indicate that, during this time, Lacey performed multiple incriminating online searches, entering the terms
normal sodium levels for a child, hypernatremia,
and
dangers of high sodium levels in a child.
At nearly midnight on Tuesday, January 14th, Lacey brought Garnet to the Good Samaritan Hospital in Suffern, New York, saying he had suffered a seizure prior to their arrival. When they saw a doctor, Lacey said Garnet had another seizure in the emergency room. Unable to find anything wrong with Garnet, despite a thorough series of tests, doctors discharged the 5-year-old boy the next day. It seems that hospital visit didn't garner Lacey the level of attention she sought, so she raised the stakes. 2 days after Garnet was discharged from the hospital, on Friday, January 17th, Lacey called her friend Una Younger in a panic, asking to use Una's car. Garnet was in bad shape, Lacey explained frantically, experiencing seizure-like symptoms, screaming and holding his head in pain. When Una arrived at Lacey's apartment, Lacey was calmly feeding Garnet through his G-tube, using an IV feeding bag filled with milky white liquid. Una later testified that she found the color of the liquid strange because Lacey had always claimed that she added healthy greens and other ingredients to Garnet's tube feedings. Another odd detail Una noticed was that Lacey was in no rush to leave. Una was more frantic than she was. Una offered to drive Lacey and Garnet to the hospital so Lacey could sit in the back seat with her son where he was strapped into a booster seat, but Lacey refused, preferring to drive herself. While driving her sick son to the hospital, Lacey inexplicably took a photo of Garnet's suffering and posted it on Facebook. When they arrived at Nyack Hospital, Garnet was admitted based on his mother's reports of seizure-like activity. Blood tests were run, and it was determined that at admission, his sodium level was 138 millimoles per liter, which was within the normal range. Because there seemed to be no visible signs of seizure activity to observe, Garnet was fitted with a video EEG, which involved a cap on his head being wired to a machine that would monitor his brain activity. As part of the test, Garnet would also be monitored by a video camera set up in his hospital room so medical staff could view his external symptoms simultaneously. Lacey was aware of and even consented to the video camera. Maybe this would be her time to shine, to prove once and for all on video what a loving, doting mother she was. The machine had the capability of recording audio as well, but the technician who set it up neglected to ensure the audio cable was secured properly, so any video captured in Garnet's room by the video EEG machine would not be accompanied by sound. Even so, what that video would eventually reveal would haunt every person who had the misfortune to see it, but more importantly, it would all but seal Lacey's fate. By Sunday, January 19, 2014, Garnet's condition had improved so much that doctors told Lacey he would soon be released. Lacey apparently had other ideas. Phone records later revealed that from her son's hospital room, sitting in the bed next to him, Lacey performed online searches regarding iodized salt and its composition. Shortly after performing those searches, Lacey was seen on the EEG video, helping Garnet out of bed and taking him to the bathroom within his hospital room. The bathroom was just outside the range of the video camera. In one shot, Lacey was holding what appeared to be a connector for Garnet's feeding tube and a white cup. Around 10:30 a.m., when the pair returned to the hospital bed from one of these bathroom trips, Garnet's condition worsened considerably, and he became visibly ill, gagging, arching his back, and writhing on the bed in pain. Despite his violent retching, Garnet was unable to throw up. If you remember, in the last episode, I mentioned that when Garnet was a baby, he underwent a surgery called a Nissen fundoplication, which renders the patient unable to vomit. At this point, more blood was drawn, at which time medical staff discovered that Garnet's sodium level had spiked to an inexplicable 182 millimoles per liter. Much later, several doctors would testify that such a sodium level could not occur naturally, which meant the sodium had been introduced into Garnet's body from an outside source. A level this high could easily be lethal. Garnet was given medication through his IV to reduce his nausea, and he was given oral ibuprofen to treat his headache. Hours later, Lacey demanded blood work be taken again to determine Garnet's sodium level. Soon afterwards, she called the nurse, Nora Bompensiero, into the room to inquire if her son's sodium level was normal, which at that time it was. Once again, Lacey was caught on the EEG video taking Garnet to the bathroom, this time actually carrying him. Again, she was also seen carrying the connector to his feeding tube. They returned to the hospital bed, and moments later, at about 4:30 p.m., Garnet developed a severe headache and became agitated once again, rolling around on the bed and violently dry heaving. Brief clips of Garnet's decline have been shown on various crime programs and online media sources. Veteran police detectives later said that the video footage of Garnet retching and writhing in agony was the worst thing they'd ever seen. Even worse, the EEG video revealed that as Garnet suffered, his mother sat next to his bed, watching her agonized little boy like a scientific experiment. Only when the nurse entered the room was Lacey seen on video rubbing his back to comfort him. About 20 minutes after Garnet took his turn for the worse, Nurse Bompensiero, who was tending to Garnet, noticed that Garnet's gastrostomy button, the cap for the feeding tube located in his abdomen and leading directly into his stomach, was wide open, even though hospital staff had not administered anything to Garnet through his feeding tube during his stay. She pointed this out to Lacey, who casually closed Garnet's G button. At approximately 5:30 p.m., Garnet appeared to have a seizure, and Lacey began screaming for medical staff to examine him. He was given more medication to control his seizures, and Lacey snapped at them to
check the labs,
insisting that the last time this happened, his sodium had been high. This turned out to be true, and Dr. Sarika Sunku, a pediatrician treating Garnet at Nyack Hospital, later testified that when Lacey was informed she was correct, she
just had a smile on her face.
Although Garnet physically presented with the visible signs of seizure, the EEG monitoring his brain told a different story. Instead of the rapid brain waves expected during a seizure, the EEG showed a significant slowing of Garnet's brain waves, which is indicative of a severe brain dysfunction. At this point, the staff at Nyack Hospital felt it was prudent to transfer Garnet to Maria Ferrari, a specialized children's hospital at Westchester Medical Center in Valhalla, New York. After stabilizing him for 2 hours, they loaded Garnet into a helicopter for the trip. Nurse Bompensiero later testified that Lacey didn't want to accompany Garnet in the helicopter, saying she was afraid and
wanted to ride with a friend and she would meet them over there.
Ultimately, staff managed to talk Lacey into boarding the helicopter with her ailing son, and he was flown to Maria Ferrari. I have to wonder if Lacey wanted to drive instead of taking the helicopter because she wanted to make a pit stop at home to destroy evidence that would later turn up. At Maria Ferrari, Dr. Carrie Goldsman, the head of the hospital's pediatric intensive care unit, took over Garnet's case. Dr. Goldsman had been filled in by phone about Garnet's condition prior to his arrival, and the doctor immediately knew something was very wrong with the situation. When he was first informed of Garnet's sodium level of 182, it was so high he assumed the lab had made an error.
Sodium 182.
182?
182.
No, then you need to repeat it. Okay, that's impossible.
Learning that Garnet had a G-tube only added to the doctor's suspicions because, like I said in the last episode, a feeding tube can be a red flag for medical child abuse. At one point after their arrival, Dr. Goldsman cornered Lacey outside Garnet's room, telling her it was metabolically impossible for Garnet's body to have produced such extreme sodium levels. Suspecting Garnet had been fed salt, Dr. Goldsman told the young mother,
"Something isn't right."
Lacey's friend, Una Younger, was present when Dr. Goldsman interviewed Lacey, who told him that earlier in the day she had given Garnet upwards of 100 ounces of water because he kept complaining that he was thirsty. Dr. Goldsman gave her strict instructions not to administer any water to Garnet because, in light of his sodium levels, it could cause a potentially lethal electrolyte imbalance. When asked when she last fed Garnet through his G-tube, Lacey told Dr. Goldsman that it was over a week ago. Una later said she was about to speak up and remind Lacey about the tube feeding she had witnessed prior to Garnet's hospital trip on January 17th, but Lacey gave her such an evil glare that Una immediately stood and left the room. Shortly after Garnet's arrival at Maria Ferrari, Dr. Jennifer Cantor, the hospital's child abuse specialist, contacted the Westchester County Police to report a potential crime. Detective Dan Carfee responded, and when Dr. Cantor detailed the situation to him, he agreed that something definitely wasn't right. At that point, he had no idea who or what may have caused Garnet's grave condition. It may have been a hospital error, child abuse, or an accident due to Lacey's use of holistic medications. But regardless, Detective Carfee had every intention of getting to the bottom of it. The detective stopped by the hospital room where Garnet lay on life support with his mother by his side. He interviewed Lacey at that time, and during the first interview, Lacey made a decent first impression with the man who would soon become the lead investigator in her son's murder case. Detective Carfi said,
"She spoke pretty well. She had a pretty good working knowledge of hospital terms and illnesses. At the exact moment, I had no reason not to believe what she was telling me."
Also during the interview, Lacey told a detective about Garnett's father, Blake, who she said had died recently. She even showed him a photo of a young man named Blake Robinson. Around the same time Detective Carfi was interviewing Lacey, her father, Terry Spears, arrived at the hospital, so the detective interviewed him afterward and learned the truth about Blake. Upon further investigation, Detective Carfi discovered that Blake Robinson was real. He was also still alive and worked as a sheriff's deputy in Morgan County. Blake and Lacey had gone on a couple dates several years before, but Blake insisted it was nothing serious or even sexual. He had no idea Lacey was using his name and photo to further her twisted narrative until Detective Carfi told him so. The detective later said,
"For me, that was the biggest red flag to Lacey's truthfulness."
Also assigned to Garnett's case were Ramapo Police Detectives Gregory Dunn and Kirk Budnick. Over the next 48 hours, Garnett remained intubated and his sodium levels were monitored. Lacey was under instructions not to give Garnett any water, which could be especially dangerous. During this time, Lacey posted frequent updates about Garnett the Great on Facebook, accompanied by heartbreaking photos of her 5-year-old son on life support. Later, friends present with Lacey at the hospital during this time would report that her behavior was strange, to say the least. One friend said,
"Her behavior was just weird in the hospital. It was not the behavior of a grieving mother. She was more concerned about what everyone else was saying, or what investigators were asking people, or what people were saying on Facebook, than putting all that aside and taking care of her child."
Around midnight on Tuesday, January 21st, 2014, Dr. Kerry Goldsman visited Garnett during his morning rounds, at which time Garnett's neurological exam was normal. About 7 hours later, at 7:15 a.m., the EEG camera recorded Garnett lying motionless in his hospital bed with Lacey lying on a cot set up beside him. Lacey rose from the cot, checked on Garnett, and quickly left the room, returning with a number of medical staff who called a code white, which is a pediatric medical emergency to which both CPR and code blue teams typically respond. Dr. Goldsman later testified that when he heard the code,
"I shot out of the office like a bat out of hell. I ran into his room. Both his pupils were blown and dilated. He was having brainstem problems."
At the same time, Dr. Goldsman spotted an empty Poland Spring water bottle on the floor just under Garnett's bed and, knowing Lacey had been specifically told not to give Garnett any water, ordered a nurse to seize it. Despite the best efforts of medical staff, 2 days after the spikes in his sodium levels, Garnett had suffered cerebral edema, which is a fluid buildup around the brain that causes increased intracranial pressure. His brain had swollen inside his skull, causing irreparable damage and forcing his brainstem to herniate. And on Tuesday, January 21st, 2014, Garnett Paul Thompson Spears was pronounced brain dead. Immediately, Lacey left Garnett's hospital room and collapsed on the floor in the hospital corridor, where, according to trial testimony, she was seen
crying and flailing
for upwards of 90 minutes. This dramatic display continued until Lacey's mother, Tina Spears, came out of Garnett's room and chastised her daughter, telling her this wasn't about her, that she needed to pull it together and be by her son's side during his final hours on Earth. Lacey was allowed to remain in the room with Garnett, but she was ordered not to leave the hospital floor. I have no doubt Lacey was legitimately upset to hear that her son would not survive this ordeal. In my opinion, I don't think Lacey intended to kill Garnett at all. I think she just wanted to keep him sick and inflame his condition when it suited her need for praise, sympathy, and attention. The investigation by the Westchester County Sheriff's Department and the Ramapo Police Department continued while Garnett remained on life support. Investigators obtained a search warrant for Lacey's apartment in Tulip House at the Fellowship Community in Chestnut Ridge, and with Lacey maintaining her vigil at her son's bedside in the hospital, police descended on Lacey's home. It was unnaturally neat and tidy, they thought, considering Lacey and Garnett had supposedly rushed out during his medical emergency on Friday. On the small kitchenette table was what appeared to be a small shrine to Garnett, including a photo, artwork, and candles, as well as 4 or 5 medications and a canister of sea salt. Detective Dunn said the apartment was an
open-setting kind of apartment, and in the middle of it was a feeding machine pump that appeared to be breast milk in the feeding bag.
Ultimately, investigators removed 170 items from the home, including over 100 holistic medications and 4 containers of salt. In a moment of oversight, they neglected to collect the feeding bag hanging in the living room and another feeding bag they had found in the kitchen garbage can, both of which were partially filled with milky liquid they assumed to be breast milk. All of the medications removed from the apartment were tested. None contained a significant amount of sodium. Investigators were certain, however, that Lacey was responsible for her son's death, their opinion based in part on her endless lies. During the investigation, they had spoken with Kim Phillipson, Lacey's former neighbor from Clearwater, Florida, who told them about Lacey's claim that her own father, Terry Spears, was sexually abusing her and was Garnett's biological father. Detectives had discovered Lacey's multiple social media profiles, but most concerning to them was the fact that she had at least 3 Facebook profiles, each of which had a different audience, so she was able to maintain strict control over who saw what. At various times, Lacey had made multiple false claims to her various groups of followers. She told some she was a wet nurse and had donated her breast milk to an infant whose mother could not nurse. She told others she had given birth to a stillborn before Garnett was born. Some were told Lacey had suffered a brain injury. Others still were led to believe that she suffered from a blood disorder that required her to receive multiple transfusions. None of these claims was true. As her son lay unresponsive in the hospital, Lacey continued blogging and posting disturbing photographs of the child she knew was unlikely to recover. According to court documents,
before and throughout the child's last hospital admission, Lacey sent many texts to friends reporting on the child's actual and purported health problems, indicating her worry for him, and asking the recipients to pray for the child. The information in the texts was often unconfirmed or contradicted by the evidence from the physicians who had treated him. She also posted photos of the child on Facebook, including photos taken after the child suffered cerebral edema and she was told that he would not likely recover.
One friend who saw Lacey taking photos of Garnett in his hospital bed said,
"It was disgusting. It was really disturbing. When your son is there and he's dying, you're going to want to hold his hand or pray or something like that." She was always doing something on her phone.
On the evening of Wednesday, January 22nd, Lacey took to social media to announce that she planned to remove her son from life support the following day.
"Tonight I sat at the bedside of my beautiful, amazing, lively, one-of-a-kind son's bed, knowing his soul is already with the angels. There's just no words to describe this horrible nightmare. Please pray Garnett's journey into the next life is nothing short of amazing."
On Thursday, January 23rd, Chris Hill, who had been alerted to his son's dire prognosis, sent Lacey a Facebook friend request. On his timeline, he posted a photo he copied from one of Lacey's profiles, along with the statement,
"This is my other son, Garnett, and he is 5 years old. I never get to see him because his mom just up and moved to New York. Well, Friday he had some severe seizures that caused his brain to swell, and now is brain dead and on life support. Even though I don't get to see him, I feel like he's been with me this whole time. I'm not going to lie, I cried for hours when I found this out, and it will continue to hurt till the day I die."
The same morning, on January 23rd, 2014, Garnett Paul Thompson Spears was removed from life support and pronounced dead. Disgustingly but predictably, Lacey hurried to Facebook, where she made a somber post stating,
"Garnett the Great journeyed onward today at 10:20 a.m.
Investigators were strongly suspicious of Lacey, but until they found solid evidence against her, they could not make an arrest. Very soon, however, they would receive 2 pieces of information that would break the case wide open. This week, I've been in contact with a new publishing company that tackles the hard topics, much like I do on this podcast. Monster Ivy Publishing is the premier publishing company of edgy, clean fiction and a proud member of Kid Lit, Creators Against Child Trafficking. They've pledged to work with Operation Underground Railroad to do all they can to help rescue enslaved children. I'll give you a little synopsis of 3 of Monster Ivy's books that address abused kids. The first is The Girl at the Hanging Tree by Mary Gray, about a woman with 2 personalities who discovers her husband is missing, only to be accused of his murder while being watched by a small-town secret society. Readers have called it The Girl on the Train Meets To Kill a Mockingbird, as it tackles abuse, mental illness, and racism. One of the main character's personalities tries to cover up the abuse the main character, Gemma, suffered as a kid. Belle of the Night by Allison Wells is set in the early 1900s in New Orleans' Red Light District. Madame Knight, the owner of a brothel, buys Belle at the tender age of 11. Years later, when a preacher comes to town, he falls in love with Belle and tries to rescue her, but she won't leave unless the other girls are freed as well. Good Girls Stay Quiet by Joe Cassidy is about 16-year-old Cora Snow, who has a secret only she and her daddy know about. Cora writes her secret in her journal, only the journal goes missing and a blackmailer threatens Cora with exposing all he knows. All of these books have been met with rave reviews and have been up for multiple awards. To learn more about Monster Ivy Publishing, visit monsterivy.com. With all the video conferencing and virtual meetings going on these days, we all want to look our best. If you're like me, you're probably confused by all the different methods of teeth whitening on the market. Now that I'm partnering with Smile Brilliant, I've learned a few things that you might find helpful about home teeth whitening methods. For example, LED lights are a novelty item. Whitening strips neglect the gum lines, crevices, and molars. Charcoal is abrasive and wears down your enamel. And whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains. So if none of these miracle products really works, what does? The number one product recommended by dentists is the custom-fitted tray, which usually costs an arm and a leg because they require a dentist to make them by hand using a model of your teeth. With Smile Brilliant's Lab Direct process, you can get custom-fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price without a single visit to the dentist. Using an exact model of your teeth, Smile Brilliant's lab technicians will handcraft your trays to give you the best possible whitening results. All you have to do is visit smilebrilliant.com, and when you order their system, make sure you use the coupon code CHILDREN at checkout for 30% off. When you receive the package from Smile Brilliant, it's really simple. You just make your dental impressions at home and return them using the prepaid envelope they provide you. In a matter of 1 week, Smile Brilliant will have your trays back in the mail. Using my coupon code, CHILDREN, means you're supporting me while saving a huge amount of money. So check out smilebrilliant.com today. One major break in the case came when, during an interview with detectives, Garnett's kindergarten teacher, Carol Greeter, who also happened to be a nurse, asked a question none of the investigators had thought to ask. According to Detective Dunn,
she said, "Was he on an EEG?" And we said, "Yes, he was." And she goes, "Well, where's the video to that?" "I didn't know there was a video to that. I didn't know the machine was hooked up to video."
The video was swiftly recovered from Nyack Hospital, and what it contained horrified the seasoned police veterans who watched it. Detective Budnick said,
"If there's one thing in this whole investigation I wish I didn't have to do, it would have been to watch that video. That video is going to stick with me for the rest of my life. I fall asleep over it. It's still very emotional." Lacey took Garnett out of the bed, walked him to the bathroom off the screen, and then Lacey seen walking past the foot of the bed to the other side of the room and comes back with a connecting tube for the feeding tube. She went back into the bathroom. A little while later, Lacey takes him out of the bathroom and puts him on the bed, and then she just looks at him as if she was waiting for something. And then his body starts shaking, and then she reaches back and she pushes the button for the nurse for the call. He was trying to vomit, but he couldn't. He's retching in pain. He's holding his head. And at some point, his body just goes stiff. And that was the last time that Garnett was alive, as far as I could see. Whatever she did to him in that bathroom is what killed him. It was the worst thing I've ever seen in my life.
Detective Dunn said,
"When he came back out of that bathroom, a few seconds, minutes, he turned into the most sick child, burying his head into the bed, the pillow, turning, retching. He was trying to throw up, but we've already known that he couldn't throw up because at 9 months old, he had an operation that kept him from throwing up. It's something that will haunt me. It was probably it's the worst video. We actually had to watch a video of a five-year-old child being murdered."
Watching Lacey Spears saunter past the camera holding a feeding tube connector and a cup, detectives finally understood how the young mother had managed to poison her son with sodium, despite no sodium being present in his IV bags in the hospital. It appeared that twice Lacey took Garnett to the bathroom, administered a salt solution through his G-tube with a syringe, and returned him to his bed, watching him with clinical interest as he began exhibiting the gruesome agony associated with salt poisoning. The second major break for investigators came in the form of a phone call from the leaders of the fellowship community, who told the detectives they needed to speak with Valerie Plochet, a community member and a friend and neighbor of Lacey and Garnett. Valerie, it turned out, had a show-stopping story to tell. According to Valerie, on January 22nd, the day after Garnett was declared brain dead, Lacey had asked her to complete an urgent task for her while she remained at her dying son's bedside, insisting it needed to be done right away but offering no explanation about why it needed to be done at all. Lacey instructed Valerie to go into their apartment, retrieve the feeding bag hanging from the stand, and dispose of it. She was not to tell anyone else about her mission, but Valerie, unsettled by the request, took another individual with her to Lacey and Garnett's apartment. Valerie placed the feeding bag into a black trash bag, but instead of disposing of it, she took it home and placed it in her closet. A day or two later, when Valerie could no longer argue with her conscience, she contacted police and let them know about Lacey's request and her subsequent retrieval of the feeding bag, which detectives quickly recovered from Valerie. They returned also to Lacey's home, where they seized the second feeding bag they had found in the garbage and failed to take with them during the first search. Within hours, lab testing of the contents of the feeding bags returned results. Each feeding bag contained massive levels of sodium. One contained the equivalent of 69 McDonald's salt packets. Investigators obtained a search warrant to seize Lacey's cell phone and laptop. Lacey's life began to fall apart. Within a week of Garnett's death, she was let go from her job as a co-worker at the fellowship community and asked to move out of her apartment in Tulip House, forcing her to move in with her parents in Kentucky. People she considered friends distanced themselves from her in the face of the ongoing police investigation. One friend who had created an online fundraising campaign to help pay for Garnett's medical expenses became so uncomfortable when Lacey asked her to change the description to state simply
expenses
that she shut down the fundraiser and returned everyone's donations. When Lacey attempted to access the PayPal account linked to the campaign and was denied, she was livid. Friends of Lacey's later reported being shocked that she was being investigated, but taking into consideration her lifetime of tall tales, they quickly began putting the pieces together. On Saturday, January 25, 2014, Garnett's organs were removed for donation, and his autopsy was performed by the Westchester County Deputy Medical Examiner. Garnett was cremated, and Lacey held a small memorial service for him in Kentucky. His remains were interred in the Mount Union General Baptist Church Cemetery in Halifax, Kentucky. Apparently feeling abandoned, a week after their son died, Lacey finally accepted Chris Hill's Facebook friend request. They began texting and even spoke on the phone a couple times. When Chris asked Lacey why she lied about Blake being Garnett's father, Lacey replied via text,
"I wanted to protect Garnett. Everything I did or said was to protect G."
In February, Lacey texted Chris,
"I need you right now. This is our son."
The next day, she texted,
"Chris, you know we will always be a part of each other's lives for the rest of our time here. We have a son together. We may not have worked out, but now we both need each other. Friends at the very least. Do you agree?"
In other messages to Chris, Lacey wrote,
"I want G back."
And,
"I feel okay at moments and then it hits me like a 1,000-pound weight."
At one point, she texted,
"I want to die."
Lacey outright denied being involved in Garnett's death in these messages, telling Chris on February 20th,
"I know they are looking at me. I would never hurt my baby."
Even while the investigation was ongoing, which was certainly no secret, Lacey continued posting online for sympathy, including a 545-word status update that included this passage.
"I will always be Garnett's mama. I will always be a mother. Nothing will ever change that. But who am I today? That I don't know."
On April 4, 2014, the medical examiner's office released its findings, ruling the 5-year-old's death a homicide caused by
hypernatremia from exogenous outside source,
resulting in brain swelling. The Westchester County Deputy Medical Examiner stated in his report that the fatal level of sodium in Garnett's body was likely caused by someone putting salt in the feeding tube. Lacey, who told a friend she expected to be arrested, obtained an attorney. In June of 2014, based on a sealed Westchester County grand jury indictment, law enforcement obtained a warrant for the arrest of Lacey Spears. The indictment document revealed what Lacey had said to investigators over the course of several interviews. At first, the document said, Lacey demanded to know what happened to her son, crying loudly for several minutes with her face buried in her folded arms, but the detective noted she did not appear to have any tears in her eyes. When the detective later told Lacey that the cause of Garnett's death may never be known, the document stated,
Lacey Spears smiled and appeared to be relieved somewhat.
At one point, Lacey told investigators that
if she mixed something that killed Garnett, it was not her fault. The medications were prescribed, and that she did not murder him.
Lacey admitted that on January 18th, while at Nyack Hospital, she fed Garnett soy baby formula through his feeding tube. She told detectives she often fed Garnett through the tube, giving him elderberry syrup, breast milk, and a new diet of blended fruits and vegetables, to which she said she liked to add
a pinch of salt for flavor.
Might I point out that these pureed fruits and vegetables, according to Lacey's own words, were being funneled directly into Garnett's stomach, bypassing his mouth entirely? If the substance is never meeting the kid's taste buds, why on earth would the flavor matter in the least? According to the indictment, Lacey also claimed that
Garnett would once in a while play with the syringe used for the GI tube feedings, and it's possible he could have put something in the GI feeding tube.
For obvious reasons, after a two-week presentation by prosecutors, the grand jury issued an indictment, and on Tuesday, June 17, 2014, 5 months after Garnett's death, Lacey walked into the back door of the Westchester County Police Headquarters in Hawthorne, New York, escorted by detectives, with her father, Terry, holding her arm. Lacey was arrested by Lead Detective Daniel Carfee of the Westchester County Police and officially charged with second-degree murder and first-degree manslaughter. She was arraigned the same day in Westchester County Court, where she pleaded not guilty to both charges. Lacey's former neighbor from the fellowship community, Christine O'Brien, watched the arraignment on television and was shocked to recognize the heavy black sweater Lacey wore as one of the garments Lacey had stolen from Christine's apartment when she and Garnett first arrived at the fellowship community. Lacey's attorneys, David Sachs and Stephen Riebling, insisted their client had not caused her son's death. Instead, they claimed Nyack Hospital was at fault, saying hospital staff had neglected Garnett during his stay there, and that a change in Garnett's diet had caused him to become dehydrated, which caused his sodium level to spike. Saying Lacey's family was not wealthy, the defense argued for a bail of no more than $150,000. The prosecution laid out the facts of his case for the court, and based on their explanation of the events leading up to Garnett's death, the judge agreed with the state's opinion that Lacey should be held without bail until her trial, which would not commence for another 8 months. As Lacey sat in jail awaiting the adjudication of her case, her family was dealt another blow. In September of 2014, Lacey's mother was diagnosed with cancer, and only a month later, Tina Elaine Florence Spears died at the age of 49, leaving behind her husband Terry, her son Daniel, and her two daughters, Rebecca and Lacey. Lacey's trial began in February of 2015 before Westchester County Judge Robert Neary. Jury selection began on February 3rd, and shortly thereafter, both the prosecution and the defense gave their opening arguments. The prosecution's stance was clear. Lacey had murdered her 5-year-old son in cold blood, poisoning Garnett with salt through his feeding tube while in the bathroom of the hospital where the EEG machine's video camera couldn't reach.
Lacey Spears is a calculating child killer who researched, planned, and executed the intentional poisoning of her son, Garnett Spears, with salt.
The defense maintained its assertion that Lacey had nothing to do with Garnett's death, which, her attorneys explained, had been caused by a mistake on the part of the hospital, not by Lacey's actions. Although the specter of Munchausen syndrome by proxy loomed large over the case, which had received worldwide publicity by that point, the concept was painstakingly avoided during Lacey's trial. Her defense team had requested that MSP not be mentioned, fearful it would sway the decision of the jury. It's possible the prosecution felt the same way, except worried it would influence the jury in the other direction, but either way, it was not introduced as part of either side's case. During the trial, the court saw 40 video clips recorded between January 18th and 19th, 2014, in Garnett's room in Nyack Hospital. The clip of Lacey passing before the camera, carrying the feeding tube connector, was played in slow motion. Some of the clips shown depicted Garnett's acute suffering during his final moments of consciousness, during which some of the jurors were seen wiping away tears. Lacey, too, put on a tearful display during the same clips. The final clip showed Garnett lying motionless in his hospital bed on January 19th. The courtroom watched Lacey rise from her cot to check on Garnett before leaving the room and returning with hospital staff. While this clip was played, Lacey began shaking and sobbing, resting her head on the defense table after the clip ended. Of the multiple doctors and medical experts called to testify for the prosecution, all of them agreed that Garnett's ridiculously high sodium level could not be explained by any natural means, and that the only explanation for the sodium spike was intentional salt poisoning. The trial dragged on for 3 weeks. Once the prosecution rested its case, surprisingly, the defense did not call a single witness. David Sachs and Stephen Riebling apparently thought they had raised enough reasonable doubt during their questioning of the state's witnesses that Lacey would undoubtedly be acquitted. Many of their lines of questioning were designed to force the medical experts to admit that diarrhea and dehydration can contribute to hypernatremia, which, admittedly, they can, but they cannot cause hypernatremia to the level Garnett experienced. Lacey did not testify on her own behalf. After the jury deliberated for 3 days, the verdict was returned. On March 2, 2015, Lacey Elizabeth Spears was found guilty of the second-degree depraved indifference murder of her 5-year-old son, Garnett Paul Thompson Spears. Depraved indifference murder is one during which the perpetrator demonstrates a complete disregard for the victim's life and safety, which, no doubt, Lacey's actions did demonstrate. Not even a week after her conviction, on March 8, 2015, Lacey appeared again before Judge Neary for her sentencing hearing. The defense argued for the minimum sentence of 15 years to life. The prosecution wanted Lacey to receive the maximum of 25 years to life. Judge Neary split the difference right down the middle, and as he announced Lacey's sentence, he finally addressed the elephant in the room.
One does not have to be a psychologist to realize you suffer from a mental illness, known as Munchausen by proxy. I hope you over the next few years come to terms with your condition. By not imposing the maximum sentence, I'm combining punishment with something that you really did not exhibit towards your son, namely mercy.
Because Lacey was initially arrested in 2014 and sentenced to 20 years to life, she will be eligible for parole in 2034 when she is just 46 years old. With any luck, to put it frankly, the parole board will see through her bullshit and deny her any kind of mercy, the same way she denied mercy to Garnett. Speaking of mercy, one thing that struck me about the sentencing was what Judge Neary said about Lacey suffering
from a mental illness known as Munchausen by proxy.
And because of this, he said he showed her mercy in sentencing. If the experts are to be believed, and I think they are, Munchausen syndrome by proxy, or MSP, is not a mental illness and should therefore not be considered a mitigating factor in criminal prosecution and sentencing. That is one of the main reasons I decided to cover Garnett's case despite the massive media attention it has already received over the years, and one of the main reasons I decided to take on MSP as a broad topic in the first place when I normally cover a specific case in each episode. In my humble opinion, based on everything I've read and seen while researching this episode, much more awareness needs to be raised about this horrific form of child abuse, which may be exacerbated by mental illness or a personality disorder on the part of the caregiver, but, and this is an important distinction, is not in and of itself a psychological diagnosis. It's one thing for a person to fake their own illness for emotional or material gain. It's something else entirely when they force illness upon someone else, especially a helpless child. In April of 2016, Lacey Spears gave her first and, to date, her only television interview to Troy Roberts of the long-running CBS News program, 48 Hours. In the interview, Lacey insisted she didn't poison her son, claiming instead that the hospital or medical staff must have made a mistake that caused Garnett's death.
They say this goes back years, how you've tried to hurt your son for years.
So you take your child to the doctor and the hospitals seeking help to figure out what was going on with them, or you neglect them, so you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. So what do they expect you to do? I took care of him. I made sure he had adequate medical history. I didn't never once harm my son.
How did your son die?
His death certificate says homicide. I didn't hurt him. I didn't kill my son.
You didn't poison your son with salt.
No, I did not. I never poisoned him with salt.
Then why is his sodium level so high?
You would have to ask the hospital that. My son is not here today because someone in that hospital screwed up and neglected to take care of him.
Were you surprised when police showed up?
Absolutely. I'm surprised that my son is brain dead. I'm surprised that all these events have transpired because one minute he's fine and the next minute he's not. You're trying to deal with your son and what has happened and transpired, and then you're thrown into the mix of police officers, investigators. I was denied time with my son, the last hours, days of his life, because I was doing everything the police ask of me so that they and myself could figure out what happened to my son.
Detective Carfi said,
Lacey seemed very interested in what was going on in the investigation.
If your child is sick and dying or perhaps brain dead, you'd want to be by that child's side. Lacey was the opposite. She wanted to spend more time with us, bringing us people to interview. It was a little bit odd.
Former neighbor Valerie Plochet was also interviewed for the program.
You know, I heard that Garnett was brain dead. And yeah, it was just so completely devastating. She asked me to go to her apartment and take the feeding bag off the stand and dispose of it.
Did you ask why?
No, I didn't ask why. I was in a very emotional state, and just any request, she could have asked me to do anything, and I would have done it because I was in such sympathy over the situation that she was losing her child.
When asked why she asked Valerie to remove the feeding bags from her apartment, Lacey spun another fanciful tale.
I didn't ask Valerie to go to my apartment and remove anything. I asked her to go and see in which state my apartment was in and what the police had been there doing.
Two feeding bags were recovered.
Yes.
And what did investigators find?
Sodium.
Why were high levels of sodium found in the feeding bags in your home?
You would have to ask the person that put it in there, because I didn't put sodium in the bag. And the proof is that when I took him to the hospital that night, had there been high levels of sodium in that feeding bag that I had fed my son out of immediately before he went to the hospital, he would have went with high levels of sodium, and he didn't.
So it magically appears?
It was exchanged between a multitude of hands before the police got it 48 hours after the bag had been taken from my home.
So someone is setting you up?
I didn't say that someone was setting me up. I'm saying that I didn't place it in the bag.
Throughout the interview, Lacey continued to play the part of the long-suffering mother, hammering home her poor me refrain.
I lost my 5-year-old son. He's not here today. I loved every part of who he was. And I'm very saddened that I'll never get to watch him grow up. You don't expect to lose your child. You don't expect to take them to the hospital and never bring them home. I miss just being able to pick him up and hug him and kiss him and tell him I love him. I miss everything about him, everything. I sit here in prison, innocent. I loved my son. He was cherished. He was taken care of. When I lost Garnet, I lost a part of who I was, and I lost my future.
Oh, did you hear that? The world's smallest violin is playing just for you, Lacey. In December of 2016, Lacey's defense attorneys appealed on the grounds that the evidence the prosecution presented was not legally sufficient to support her conviction. 10 months later, in October of 2017, a panel of state appellate judges denied the appeal and ruled against overturning Lacey's murder conviction, saying the evidence proved
beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted under circumstances evincing a depraved indifference to human life.
Although the appellate panel found that Judge Neary was wrong to allow a Wikipedia article about hypernatremia into evidence without authenticating the information in the article, the panel found this
harmless error
would not have changed the jury's decision. Unsatisfied with the decision of the appellate panel, defense attorneys David Sachs and Stephen Riebling requested the appeal be reviewed by the New York Court of Appeals, the state's highest court. In January of 2018, their request was denied as the court declined to hear the appeal. After the ruling, the defense team said in a statement,
"Of course, it is extraordinarily disappointing that the Court of Appeals has decided not to permit Lacey to file an appeal. We feel very strongly that if the Court of Appeals had permitted the appeal and reviewed the full merits of the case and the law, that Lacey's conviction would have to be reversed. At this juncture, all of Lacey's legal remedies will be explored, including appealing to the federal court."
As yet, it does not appear a federal appeal has been filed on Lacey's behalf. Currently 33 years old, Lacey Elizabeth Spears is incarcerated in the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, a maximum security women's prison in Bedford Hills, New York, where, coincidentally, another perpetrator I'll talk about in the next episode also served her sentence. Lacey continues to claim she is innocent. Lacey's sister, Rebecca, told author John Glatt, who wrote the book on Garnet's case called My Sweet Angel, that the other inmates in Bedford Hills bullied Lacey. During mealtimes, Rebecca said,
"When she walked through the line and it would be her turn to pick up the tray, someone would put salt packets over her meal and then hand the tray to her."
Lacey refused protective custody in prison because she couldn't stand the thought of being sequestered in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. Who would listen to her fairy tales then, right? Lacey herself told John Glatt,
"It's been brutal here. Crimes involving children are considered the worst here. I hear them talking behind my back, calling me baby killer, child killer, and mother of the year. But I know it's not who I am."
At this point, I'm betting you're about as sympathetic to Lacey's self-inflicted plight as I am. To end this episode, I want to take some time to remember Garnet, who is unfortunately often overshadowed by his mother's misdeeds. This is both my favorite part of every episode and the hardest of all to get through, but keeping these kids' memories alive is so incredibly important. Garnet Paul Thompson Spears was a loving, bright, lively, sociable, active, articulate, happy child, and a social butterfly. He had an uncanny ability to remember the names of everyone he met, and he loved talking to people. His favorite colors were red and purple, and his favorite foods were bananas and yogurt. Garnet loved Thomas the Tank Engine and trains in general. He also loved banging on his toy drum set and playing with Lego, coloring, playing outside, and eating. While living in Florida, Garnet loved going to a nearby beach called Honeymoon Island and building sandcastles.
He liked driving around in his little electric tractor, pulling his stuffed animals behind him in a wagon. And while he lived in Florida, he almost always wore a tie-dyed t-shirt. Garnet enjoyed drawing chalk pictures on the sidewalk and planting pinwheels in the rock garden. Valerie Plochet said Garnet was outgoing, adorable, full of energy, and coordinated, and had excellent social skills. She described him as
a really special child. I used to swing with him all the time. Garnet used to come to my apartment pretty much every day. He would come over and yell at the bottom of the stairs, "Valerie! Valerie, can I come up?"
When interviewed for 48 hours, Valerie said of Garnet,
"He connected with people, and he made people feel loved. He was this soaring spirit of goodness, and that's how we should remember him and honor him."
Another neighbor from the fellowship community, Una Younger, and her husband, Howard, spent a lot of time with Garnet. A few years after his death, Una remembered,
"I loved to give him baths. He had enough bath toys to build his own shipyard, and he always seemed happiest in the tub. He always had that beautiful smile and those sparkling eyes while in the water."
On the five-year anniversary of Garnet's death, Una posted on Facebook,
"Garnet, it's been 5 years since you went to heaven. Every single day since then, Howard and I remember you with love bursting out of our hearts and smiles on our faces as we reminisce about the times that we were together. We hold tight to your sweetness, kindness, and passion for life. You are loved and poignantly missed every day."
Rest well, Garnet. You will never, ever be forgotten. That's it for this week. In the next episode, part 3 in my series about Munchausen syndrome by proxy, I'll tell you the stories of several other children affected by medical child abuse. Join me next week for part 3. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music, and all music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildrenpod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.